Welcome, everyone, to our Parshat Vayishlach 5777 2016 review of the upcoming Parsha. We're calling the class To Snatch Defeat from the Jaws of Victory. In our little picture at the top, you see Jacob bowing down, and that is supposed to be Esau, dear brother Esau, coming on his horse, and there are 400 men in the background there, or supposedly represented like 400 men. So we begin our parsha with source number one. Jacob wrestles with Esau's protective angel. An amazing moment. Unfortunately, tragically, because of the wrestling match, even though Jacob wins, he gets his thigh socket damaged, and all those porterhouse sirloin steaks are forever verboten, off the table for Jewish people because of that wrestling match.
What is the significance of that?
We're going to talk about it on Shabbos. I know, that's where the sciatic nerve runs, and that's what was damaged, apparently, by the angel in the attack. The significance of the sciatic nerve is very interesting. I'll just very, very briefly touch on this. He wanted to damage his children. So that area where he touched is by the groin. He couldn't get Jacob for Jacob now, but he wanted to allude to future issues that Jewish people would have with idols and things, that people would descend from Jacob. So he metaphorically hit him in the groin, so to speak, to show that I'm going to hurt your future generations, trying to destabilize Jacob and make him doubt himself. That's the metaphor. Okay? So let's get back on number one.
He's been in like a 5-minute timeout to read these like in the sports.
I know. Well, he didn't have that, unfortunately. So he, the angel, Esau's protective angel, said to Jacob, after Jacob perseveres, no longer will it be said that your name is Yaakov, Jacob, which of course comes from the word heel, which has connotations of being underhanded, duplicitous. But Israel, Yisrael, for you have striven with the divine, moi, me, an angel, and with man, both your brother Esav and your evil uncle Lavan, and Vatuchal, and you have overcome everyone. You deserve the mantle of Israel. So this is the first time that a Jew becomes the nation of Israel. It wasn't Abraham, it wasn't Isaac, for other reasons. Jacob becomes Yisrael, Israel. Now, Yisrael has two, perhaps, very famous meanings. Yisrael could mean Yashar Kel, to be straight, Yashar, to be upright, truthful with God. Or it could mean Yashar Shrirut, to fight, to engage in this world. Either way, the mantle of Israel, of Israel, was won by Jacob in battle, if you will. Later on in our parsha, in our Vayishlach, God will visit with Jacob and also formally dub him Yisrael. You're the one Israel, who we are named after. Now, it's interesting that Jacob retains ownership over both names. Sometimes he's called Yaakov, Jacob, later on, and sometimes it's referred to as Israel, as Yisrael. Now, what is important about that first source is this is Jacob at the height of his superpowers. He has just destroyed, in battle, one-on-one, an angel. Or at least, he didn't lose. And when you draw with an angel, you get the decision on your side. So we give the decision to Jacob. He wins the big WrestleMania, the original WrestleMania, way before Andre the Giant existed. And earlier on, he had spent 20 years with wicked uncle Lavan, and yet he was a man of total integrity, total honesty. He had never allowed the 100 times, for example, that Lavan played with his wages unilaterally. That's always a fun thing when you sign a contract and someone unilaterally changes the contents of the contract 100 times plus, and you don't make a big fuss. And he won everything in the end. He vanquished Lavan. The children, the kids, the daughters, the wealth, the goats, the sheep. Everything became Jacob's. So it's safe to say at this moment in his life, he's ready for Esau. You know, as they say, bring him on, I'm ready for you. And in fact, it's interesting. He sends messengers, and the rabbis debate whether this is a good or a bad idea, to allow notice to be given to Esau. I'm back. So some say he should have just sort of come back quietly and not notified dear brother Esau and let Esau find out on his own through Twitter or other issues. But at this point in time, he sends the angels, the messengers, and he says to them, when you find my brother Esau, give him the following message. And it was thought through. It was nuanced. It was pointed. In Lavan Garti, I have dwelled with wicked uncle Lavan. And the word Garti is a play on words, because it doesn't just mean I live with them, but the word Taryag, the 613 commandments, can be found in those letters. And he was telling dear brother Esau, you know what Uncle Lavan's like. You know what happens when you enter the dark side of the world with Lavan. How could a person possibly hold on to his innocence and his Torah ideals? Well, I did successfully navigate that minefield. So this would be a shot to the bow of the HMS Esau. When he would hear about this, he'd be like, oh my gosh, you mean Jacob the Goody Two-Shoes? Is still Jacob the Goody Two-Shoes after sojourning with Lavan for 20 years? And that would increase Esau's, shall we say, nerves. He would be like, oh my gosh, I better not mess with this guy. And then when he finds out that he kind of played with your protective angel and you're just the human flesh embodiment and he beat your ethereal self, Esau's probably ready to pack it in at that moment. And yet, what does Jacob do? As we're going to see tonight, he does what Neville Chamberlain so infamously did. He capitulates. Peace in our time. He gives away the store in a most profound way. And what we're going to try to understand tonight, why in the world, if Jacob has all the power, the nuclear option, to destroy once and for all, to vanquish dear brother Esau, instead, he manages to snag defeat from sure victory. That's the whole idea. Why capitulate when you have the power? That's our question tonight. And we will see how he capitulates. Look at number two. Direct quote from our Parsha, Genesis 33. Yaakov, Jacob, prostrated himself on the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. Number three, he did not stop bowing and then bowing again and again and again until he reached his brother. Stop for one moment. So Esau comes with his 400 men. Dear brother Jacob, gee, I've heard that you're hot stuff. You vanquished our uncle. I hear you have God. You're still great. If you're so almighty powerful, how come you're sending me 500 plus animals as a bribe, as a gift, which shows that you're concerned by my power, Esau must be thinking. And if you're so hot stuff, why are you bowing as if like I am the man and you have the nuclear option? Could be that they've exaggerated your powers, clearly. So what happens? Esau comes close and famously they run to each other. And you know the famous story where Esau hugs him and kisses him and tries to perhaps rip his throat out with his teeth. But God saves Jacob, and his throat kind of turns to like marble, and he cracks his teeth. All right, there's interesting stories. What's going on in Esau's mind? But clearly the two brothers come together. The pegisha, as we call it. The fateful meeting that will decide forever the nature of who the Jews are and who kind of the rest of the world is, for all intents and purposes. Civilization, this moment would define all of future civilization. So what does Esau say to his brother, Jacob? Number four, Esau said, okay, Jacob, let us travel onwards together, and I will walk as your counterpart. And what he really meant in number five, and this is from the mystical Zohar, if any of you are interested in Kabbalah, this is a quote from the Zohar, the Book of Mystery, that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai wrote. Really what Esau was telling him was, let's proceed together, dear brother. We will divide this world and rule together. Stop. Let's hearken back to last week. Do you remember in the class last week? We said that this was the original vision that Isaac had Do you remember? Isaac always imagined a world where Esau, the twin, and the other half, the other twin, Jacob, would be partners. Jacob would master the spiritual realm, Esau, the physical realm, and together they would master the world, which is ostensibly what Esau at this moment is offering to Jacob. Now, it sounds inviting, at least superficially. Not only does Jacob say no, he gets down and grovels at Esau's feet. Listen to the words now, the next words in source number 6, and they're in Hebrew there because they're powerful. With these 5 words, he becomes Neville Chamberlain. Yavarna Adoni Lifnei Avdo. Jacob says to Esau in response to the offer of let's be partners, please let my master pass ahead of his servant. Please let my master pass ahead of his servant. But what he really meant, look at number 7, was the following. Again, this is the Zohar, the mysterious book of brightness giving us insight. Jacob said, let Esau master civilization first. I will have to suffer your exile, Esau, until the time comes for me to rule the mountain of Esau. Now, we actually say this in our liturgy. We say, Va'alu Moshim Lishpot et Har Esav, that in the end of times, when Messiah comes, when Mashiach will come, we will go up and judge Esau. But that's not until the end of times.
Where is this?
This is quoted in our liturgy. It's in one of our tefillos. Well, I'll show you after the class with pleasure. Now, let's stop for 1 second. So Jacob has an offer from Esau. Let's be partners. Now, let's just play a little devil's advocate for a moment, okay? Let us say that Jacob has valid reasons why he doesn't want to be a partner with Esau. I would. Then why doesn't he use his power and say, look, you know, Esau, it's a very tempting offer. With all due respect, dear brother, I turn you down. Do you want to make something of it? You go on ahead. I'll master the world. Do you have something to say, dear brother? Oh, really? Your angel had something to say last night. He gave me the blessing of Israel. Do you want to add something to that? But no. He is almost like a coward, the way he just grovels at the feet of Esau and says, you know what, dear brother, you pass on ahead. This is a metaphor, meaning the world is your oyster. It's yours. I'll take what's left. You want to throw me a couple of bones along the way? The Jewish people will have, like, maybe the banking industry or the whatever we're going to run in the world. You master civilization first, I come second. And if you think about the way the Jewish people have, in reality, survived millennia of exile, think about how we always behaved. We always found a little area where the Gentile nation that was in charge of the world allowed us to master, right? Sometimes it was finance, very often, which did not always play out well. And other times there were just little areas where they said, you know, you choose, as long as you stay in one definable area, you can call it a ghetto, you can call it the Jewish area, whatever you want to do. As long as you Jews behave yourselves and know your limitations, know who you are, we'll allow you to survive the exile, providing that you give us service, that you are something that will be useful to us. And we've always been useful. We've always somehow been able to figure out what the non-Jewish nations want from the Jews, and we've always been very successful. Okay. What is going on here? Let's just reiterate now for Dr. Kelman, for everyone, the focus of our class. Here comes Jacob Israel, hot off a knockout decision in the wrestling match of Esau's spiritual self, the essence of Esau, his angel. He wins the day. He comes after mastering Laban for 20 years. He's at the height of his powers, and he even sends cryptic messages to Esau. Don't mess with me, dear brother. I'm not who you remember from our childhood. So don't mess with me. But then the reality becomes totally the opposite, 180 degrees. When they two brothers come, and Esau's sort of like a little deferential to him. He says, you know, keep your blessings, keep your presence, I don't want. Jacob insists, keep what I brought you. It's all yours. And then Esau says, okay, fine. I'll keep it, but let's become brothers. Let's make a rapprochement. You and me, the children of Isaac, the children of Rebekah, let's master this world together as partners. Let's go shoulder to shoulder. What do you say, you? And then what does he say? We said in number 6, please let my master pass on ahead of his servant. And in those 5 words, he gives the keys to this world, the Olam Hazeh. He says, here, dear brother Esav, you go ahead. I got lots going on. And he even says it in a very profound way. He says, look, Esav, I got a lot of children. Got a lot of diapers to change. Got a lot of stuff going on in my life. I can't deal with the big politics that you have in store to rule this world. So you know what? You want to throw me a little bone here or there. The Jewish people will be very happy being, we'll play secondary. We'll play second fiddle to your mastery of the world. And of course, the reality has been exactly what Jacob did. He gave it away. Now, this is not a small issue. Let's look at number 8. In response to Jacob saying to Esav, you command the world, God says, Jacob, we're going to play it by your rules. Look at the amazing quote number 8 from the Pirkei de Rebbe Eliezer, which is a famous midrash, famous oral tradition. The Holy One, Kadosh Baruch Hu, said, by your life, Jacob, we'll play it just as you say. Esav is going to dominate you in this world. Stop for a second. The most famous progeny who descend from Esav, of course, are the Romans, the Roman Empire. Really, for all intents and purposes, with no slight to the Greeks, the dominant culture that founded Western civilization. And their children, by and large, now again, we're talking about massive, you know, intermingling of DNA from everywhere, but by and large, Western civilization kind of descend from Esav, from the Romans, genetically. The Germans, the Brits, you look, most of the great families have this yichus, this genealogy. Again, it's not clear, it's not like you're a Kohen and Aaron's your great-grandfather, we understand this. But at least on a sequence of DNA, you see the connection between Esav and what we call Western civilization. Please turn your page now over number 9. Now this is not a small issue. How amazing is it that not only did God say, we play by your rules, Jacob, if you want Esau to dominate, he takes the keys to this world. The Romans themselves, apparently, used to read the Bible. And they were very slow readers. So when they got to this section, this is a Talmud and Tractate of Avodah Zarah, the Romans, listen to this, for 26 years, Rome kept her treaties with Israel, but then turned and subjugated Israel. Well, what happened? What went wrong after? Originally, the Romans followed the lesson of Esau's first offer. Let us travel onwards together, and I will walk as your counterpart. So the Romans said to themselves, it's good enough for dear great-granddad Esau to be happy with the Jews. Who am I to differ? And then, I guess it took him 26 years to get to the next verse. And then when they finally got to the next verse, they got to the response of Jacob, which was, no, dear brother, I don't want to be your counterpart in this world. You go on ahead. But then they followed the lesson of Jacob's reply. Yavor nadani lifnei abdo. Please, my master, pass on ahead of your servant. And then they changed their tune versus the Jews, and we started getting some bad, ugly stuff that occurred with the Romans vis-a-vis Israel and the Jews. Number 10. The entire period that Jacob spent in Beit El, he would continuously honor Esav with more tribute. Esav acted offended, but he kept his hand open the whole time. Let's stop for a second. Jacob is a very bright guy. He's Israel. So whatever he does for our benefit. He's not looking at a temporary situation. He's looking at us sitting here right now tonight, learning Torah together. That's how far into the future he's trying to anticipate the ramifications of his dialogue with Esau in this parsha are felt ad hayom hazeh, to this day. So why would he give away the store? Why would he give away the world? He must have had a plan. And I'm going to offer you tonight the following. Yes, indeed, Jacob had a plan. He spoke to Esau deliberately and allowed Esau the keys to this world to protect our lives, to make it possible for Jewish survival in exile under the oppression of Esau's progeny. We're going to see this now. So the first key is that Jacob understood that what does Esau want? He wants bribes. But he doesn't want it overt. He wants it very subtly. He wants the money, but he doesn't want to be made aware of the fact that he's kind of accepting money. He's compromised, but he doesn't want it like sort of like a public knowledge type thing. So what does Esau really, really want? So in his mind's eye, when he was a kid, what did he want? He wanted a way out of the responsibility of keeping the Torah, doing mitzvos, going to shul, heaven forbid having to hear the rabbi go on endlessly with his sermons. He didn't want that stuff. So when he's offered a red lentil dish, and some coins, by the way, there were gold, there was gold involved in the transaction, Jacob said, hey, dear brother, if you really don't want all this nonsense, if it's to you gobbledygook, if it's a very sort of huge mantle to be Israel, and you're the Bechor, you're the firstborn, I'll buy it from you. What say you? And the same thing happens here. Jacob says to Esau, look, why don't you just take this world? What does Jacob know? Let me offer you the following mindset of Jacob. Jacob knows that if Esau becomes hot to trot about religion, it will not end well for the Jewish people. And we're going to explore this tonight. Whenever Esau becomes spiritually excited, the Jews suffer. So he wants to keep Esau relaxed about religion. He wants to keep him there on the periphery, not going to synagogue, not going to temple. He just wants to keep him very blasé and not excited about religious matters. Because, you know what? Jacob understands something about Esau. Esau is a man of this world. How do we know this? It says right in the Torah. He was the Ish Sadeh. He was a man of the field. And in fact, it's interesting. What do you call your chosen occupation in the world? We say, colloquially, it's your field of endeavor. So it's a person who accomplishes in this world. He's the man of the field. He's the man of this world. And we know, and I mentioned this last week, the blessings given by Isaac to the brothers are decidedly different. One is a future blessing. Yitain, God shall give you, meaning in Olam Haba, in the next world. Whereas with Esau, his blessing is Hine. Here is the bounty of this world. Enjoy it now. In other words, Esau's all about this world, and Jacob is about surviving this world and doing the best we can, but ultimately keep our eye on the ball. And the ball is Olam Haba, the next world. And this is what Jacob is trying to accomplish. He understands that if dear brother Esau and he are partners together in this world, it will not end well. One will eat the other alive. Esau will kill Jacob. So listen to what he does. First he starts giving him gifts, but not calling them bribes. Just says, look, I want to honor you, dear brother. And look at number 11, which is an amazing quote. The world was created only for two people. Amazing. Only for the completely evil or the completely righteous. For one, meaning the good, there was created Olam Haba, the next world, the world to come. For the other, the evil, there was created Olam Hazeh, this world. In other words, Jacob understood that the only place that Esau will be fulfilled is if he is allowed free reign in this world. And if religion comes along and mixes up Esau, and Esau starts to feel guilty, I can't do this, I can't do that, because I'm constrained by the rules of religion, no way, it's not going to work well. So deliberately, Esau is given total license to do whatever he wants to do in this world by Jacob. He wants him free of religion, of the yoke. And how do we know that this is such a huge thing? Look at number 12. Because the Zohar, once again, our third quote tonight, from the mysterious book of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the Book of Brightness, Esav hated the birthright in the first place, as we said earlier, and would have eventually begged Jacob to take it off his hands, even if he would have had to pay Jacob later on. In other words, the whole 15-year-old, we're children, Abraham died, you have that red lentil cholent, I want the beans. All of that was just a play allowing Esau to cop out of this world. In other words, later on he would have come to the same conclusion on his own. Number 13. Let me ask you in a humorous way. If you're meeting Esau after 20 years, and he's coming with 400 generals, and you don't really understand, Jacob doesn't understand his intent. Is it a military or an overture of honor? You're bringing 400 generals to show me honor. He doesn't know. Nobody really knows. Even when they kiss, right? One rabbi says, well, he tried to rip his throat out. The other one says, no, even though he's Esav and he's wicked, at that moment he was moved and he loved Jacob. So nobody, there's a lot of ambiguity about the relationship. They themselves may not have known. Let me ask you a question. Jacob has had 20 years to think of the dialogue that is going to transpire between he and his brother. Okay? What if dear brother Esau still hates my guts over the incident when I dressed up as him and took from dad the blessings? Let me ask you, what is the one word that you would move heaven and hell to never say when you're talking with Esau during the meeting? How about the word blessing? Would you really use the word bracha with somebody who maybe is like still fuming at the idea that you stole my bracha? And it's crazy because not only does he use the word, but he uses the word as a word to describe the gifts that he gave. And we know there's so many other choice words, like maybe matana, a gift, the mincha, the tribute. But no, look at number 13. He says to him, please take my bracha, my birchati, as it has been brought to you. What? Why would you even use that word to bring up, to dredge up old feelings? Listen to this, number 14. So Jacob says to Esau, you know what? I don't want the blessing. Esau, if it means so much to you, have my blessing, have your blessing. I love this quote. Said Jacob to Esau, take both blessings, yours and mine. Take my blessing. Here, it's yours. Esau said, no. Hey, that's not fair. I want only the blessing that was originally meant for me by my father. The blessing that was meant to be yours should now go back to you. Let's switch. So they wrote up a contract between them. I love this. And signed on transferring the blessings back to the way they were meant to be. So the blessing that was given to Jacob goes back to his brother Esau from Isaac and vice versa. Listen to this. I love this moment. Esau came triumphantly home, but everyone objected. He said, guys, you won't believe it. After 20 years, I got the blessing. And everyone looked at him. His family said, are you nuts? What have you done? What you have done is ridiculous. You took blessings focused on the next world, Olam Haba, and left Jacob with this world. Don't you understand, dear dad, dear grandfather? You're the one. Aren't we living high on the hog here? Why would you want to start going to shul? Why would you want to start keeping kosher and all this crazy mitzvahs? Please, go back to Jacob and beg him to tear up the contract. We like it the way it is. So when it says that Esau came back to Jacob and begged him, tear up the contract. Now, obviously, whether this happened in reality, but it's giving voice to the idea that Esau was deserving of the mantle of this world because it was designed for him. And Jacob is designed for the next world. And Jacob understood this, as we are now understanding it tonight. Now, let me ask you a question. Did Esau ever have any feeling about what he lost? Yes. When Jacob stole, in the eyes of Esau, the blessing, dressed as Esau, he leaves the tent going this way. Esau comes in. Esau says, Dad, get up and bless me. And then when it becomes clear what had happened, and there's no blessing left, do you remember what Esau did? He cried. He cried. But it wasn't a normal cry. Look at number 15. When Esau heard his father's words, he screamed an exceedingly anguished and bitter cry. And he said, this is Genesis 27, bless me too, my father, bless me. And he cried like a child. But that cry got paid back big time. Because Jacob made Esau cry, we cried. Mordechai, in the story of Purim, knew what was happening when Haman, the great-grandson of Esau, sent the letter to annihilate and exterminate the Jews. When he knew what was happening, and Mordechai tore his clothes, and look at the words the Megillah says, and he cried an exceedingly anguished and bitter cry. And the rabbis connect the two cries. Because the cry of Esau over the loss of the blessings. Now again, when he's crying, he's probably crying over who he could have been in another world, in another life. In other words, he's a kid. He doesn't really want the blessing. If you sat down with him in the cold, hard light of day, say, Esau, the blessing Dad gave you about getting wealthy and having a great time and partying on in this world, it's exactly what you want. Yes? He would say, yes. But I lost the chance to be the Jews. I could have been Jacob. I could have been Abraham and Isaac and Moses. That could have been my legacy. And so a small part of him cried a bitter, anguished cry for one moment. But in that one moment of heartfelt religious inspiration, it almost killed the Jews. Because Haman comes along generations later, who's descended from Esau, it's his great-grandson. And because of that bitter cry, he makes Mordechai, Jacob's great-grandson, cry a bitter cry. He almost killed us. Oh my gosh. So in one moment then, of heartfelt religious inspiration, Hitler is created essentially and almost kills the Jews. Do we now understand how serious the issues are? Jacob has to keep Esau lethargic and apathetic about religion. Because if he gets anywhere near religion, we go to the Auschwitz. That's basically where we wind up. Not a good thing. So I would dare say, this is my thesis from my Rebbe, Rabbi Weinberg, everything Jacob did, pass on before me, my master, you take this world, was designed specifically to keep Esau basically religion light. You don't want him going to synagogue. You don't want him getting too worked up about keeping the Torah and going to shul. Forget about once a year, once in a lifetime is too much. For he knew if Esau becomes a religious creature, it will be a death knell to Jacob's grandchildren. We will not survive the exile under Esau. Let's stop for a second. Here's the question. It sounds fantastic. Again, the answer is beautiful, right? Why did he capitulate? He didn't capitulate. He just knew that the nature, the essence of Esau is that if he gets worked up about religion, the Jews die. So I have to figure out a plan to let him master this world. Why? Because Esau was designed for this world. If religion puts constraints on Esau's ability to enjoy this world, who do you think he takes that out on? The Jew. Let me ask you, did it work? The answer is no.
No, not at all.
But why didn't it work? You know why it didn't work? And this is where we're going to get a little politically incorrect. It didn't work for one simple reason. It worked, by the way, for hundreds of years. Until the church came around. Changed everything. Now, this is politically incorrect, but let's speak candidly, okay? What does the church offer to the Romans, who are the descendants of Esau? And this is not an exaggeration. You'll know I'm speaking the truth. They say to dear brother Esau, you are the new Israel. They don't say that Jesus in the New Testament is a new religion. It's Judaism. But it's Judaism with a brit chadash, with a new contract, because God has forsaken the Jews. You, Esau, you thought you gave it all up when you sold the birthright? I have good news. Jesus is the way. You have salvation at hand. Just become religious. You can become Jacob. And that's why they're the new Israel. They don't believe that. You hear it? So the Roman Empire, because of one very sad old emperor, Constantine, before his death, who took upon himself this new cult called Christianity and made it officially the religion of the Roman Empire, Jacob and all his plans were undermined in one fell swoop. Let's look now at the last 2,000 years of Jewish history and Roman, shall we say, Catholic history and everything else. Has it been a very good 2,000 years for the Jews?
No.
How many millions of Jewish lives have been lost? You can't even count them. They're almost incalculable, correct? So I'm offering you tonight, this is the politically incorrect part. Jacob was a genius. He saw it all. But he was undermined by the idea that somebody would come along in a future and offer salvation to dear brother Esau. Now, poor Esau doesn't know what hit him. Because on one hand, he accepts the new religion, he becomes religious, but then there's a bunch of rules. You can't rape, you can't commit adultery, you can't murder. And Esau's thinking to himself, why did I buy into this? This is my life's blood. And you're telling me I have to deny myself? Now I have hundreds of rules? Aife, what did I get into? But if you want to be Jacob, these are the rules. So you know what the saddest and most tragic thing is? Is that poor Esau tries it out. And he hates it. Because the constraints of this religion are so overwhelming. He's denied. What is he denied? His own calling. What is his calling? This world. But he's not allowed to harvest this world to make money and to create power because guilt is thrown into the mix. And once he's denied his calling, he's outraged and he's angry. How does that anger foment itself? Antisemitism and pogroms and blood libels. Because once you say to Esau, you're Jewish, you're Israel, but he can't be Israel. And you say, by the way, all the good stuff of this world, taboo, verboten, it's off the plate now. And poor Esau tries his best. He goes to church, he's from, he tries his best. But does he feel in his soul fulfillment? No, he can't feel fulfillment because we said the only way he can be fulfilled is having the world, having no constraints. Religion should be religion light, not a draconian-style religion. So for 2,000 years, Esau, Western civilization, has felt almost like chained by the rigors of organized religion. And it's almost destroyed the Jews. I mean, you can count how many times we almost lost our lives. We were extinguished at the hands of Esau. But we're not going to end on a sad note. We're going to end on a glorious note. There's one country, and we're living in it, which has been the greatest blessing for the Jewish people in history. The United States of America. Why is that? Why are we living hundreds of years now, Baruch Hashem, free from pogroms and blood, whatever you want to say is fomenting on the extreme, it's nothing compared to Europe. Europe is blood-soaked with our people's blood for millennia, right? America has been the greatest bastion for Jewish people. Why? Because think of the founding fathers and how we exist. Freedom and religion. There's no such a thing as a church or a religious body running the government. That doesn't exist. Those people who founded our beloved country ran away from that type of European oppression. So any religion that is practiced in America, and tell me if I'm wrong here, I don't believe I am, it's very much religion light. You can go to church on Sunday, but then you got football and the barbecues, and even the Catholic faith that they have in America, they don't even hold by the doctrines of Italy. They don't even recognize most of the strictures and all the laws that the Pope and everybody decides in Rome. They're decidedly a different religion. It's very relaxed. It's much more at ease, and it's tolerant. And I would offer you, that's what Jacob wants to do. He wants to keep Esau tolerant. Not to look out jealously at dear brother Jacob. How come you have this and I don't have this? No, 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 no. So America has been the greatest bastion for our people. So again, let's have a look at what could happen in a nightmare situation. Okay, number 16. It says, Timna was a mistress to Eliphaz. Basically, this gives you the creation of the Amalekites. She was a mistress to the son of Esau, Eliphaz, the one who mugged Jacob for money, they created this animal called Amalek. And Amalek, not only does he want to destroy the Jews pathologically, he won't take money. Do you remember how Jacob kept sending gifts and money to Esau? There's no way to buy your way out of Amalek's bad feelings. Look what Haman, I'll just paraphrase number 17. Haman offers the king $400 million of silver to kill the Jews, to commit genocide. Can I tell you something about the Holocaust? And it's really tragic. Many Jews in Europe underestimated the pathological nature of the Nazis, Yimach Shemah. They believed that in the same way we bought our way out of past pogroms and past threats, we can always grease the wheels. Didn't work with the Nazis. You couldn't buy them off with money. And even most tragic of all, the Hungarian Jewish community, which really had the most money per capita of any Jewish community, they believed till the bitter end in 1944 that they could use their money to influence and to buy their way out. The only problem is they're not dealing with a conventional Esav. They're dealing with a Malek, who is this monstrosity who descends from Esav and who can't be bought off. He's even willing to spend his own money to destroy the Jews. And if you want to see an amazing quote, this is from the Talmud. You're not going to believe this is in the Talmud that was written 2,000 years ago, but look at this. Number 18. Said Jacob to the Holy One, he prayed to God, Master of the universe, Ribono Shel Olam, do not allow Esav his heart's desire. Do not remove his bit. This prayer refers to Germania of Edom. Edom is the nation of Esau. For if they were to be let loose, they would destroy the world. Germania is Germany. Now, obviously, it's not the country Germany in the modern sense. It is a tribe, a Germanic tribe. But in the Talmud, 2,000 years ago now we're talking, they wrote about how dangerous it could be for the Jews should the little segment, if you will, of Esau's children, what we call the Amalekite segment, if they would be let loose, if Germania, if the Germans, the bit is taken out of their mouth and they're allowed to do what they want to do, the world will be destroyed. I mean, how prophetic is that? It's an amazing idea. So let's just step back for a second. Jacob tries his best not to give away the store for no purpose, but to allow Esav to express himself in this world, in Olam Hazeh, because Esav designed for this world. And it worked really, really well. But then when the Roman Empire declare Christianity, and that Esav, you haven't lost forever that blessing, the one that you were going to pay Jacob to get, you could still be new Israel, you can have a Brit Chadash, a new covenant with God. Poor Esav buys into it, lock, stock, and barrel. The problem is, he tries very hard at the religious stuff. He suppresses his own worldly desires where he feels fulfillment, and it manifests itself. And if you look at the history of Europe, the more draconian the church-run state, whether it's Poland, Spain, go through the litany of every country that persecuted Jews, the more the church were in power, the worse it was for the Jews. Always. Because Esav gets angry, there's hatred in his heart. And to contrast that, we say what a blessing America is, that we've been given this country, which has a very Esav-like bent. Think about America. Nobody judges Esav here. Oh, you want to marry someone who's you're not supposed to marry? Yeah, it's okay. Who am I to judge? Who am I? That's another lifestyle. It's okay, right? In America, it's ultimate tolerance. Esau can basically do whatever he wants. Nobody judges him. Wow. And of course, if he's allowed to express himself fully and kind of, it's just another lifestyle or another way of looking at it, no one judges him. America, we don't judge anybody. It's beautiful. Esau's allowed just to express himself fully as himself, the man of the field, the man of accomplishment. And guess what he does to Jacob? Live and let live. I don't have a problem with Jews. Yeah, I'll even support Israel. I'll even lobby for Israel in the government. Because why not? Why not? I'm happy. I have millions. I'm controlling the world. Why can't I? You want to hear a delicious little idea? Tibbet, my Rosh Hashiva came up with. I'll end with this. In order to keep Esau successful in Europe and in America, what was the most critical component? To establish a financial system. A financial system that would make it possible for Esav to accrue his enormous wealth and to benefit from this world. Can you tell me what Jewish family, this is historical, just Google it tonight, what Jewish family created the Western monetary system?
Rothschild.
Thank you. Can you translate the name of the family for me? Roth means red. Shield of the red. Protector of Mr. Red. the family's name, Rothschild, is the one who protects and looks after Mr. Red. Who do you think Mr. Red is? Edom, Esau. I don't know what to make of that. Maharaj Shiva has it as a throwaway line at the bottom of one of his Torah talks. He says, by the way, Rothschild means protector of the Red One. Amazing. So you have a family that dedicates itself to establish Western financial values that will allow Esav to fully express himself in this world. So again, we want to bless America for what it has given to our people, for the protection it's given to our people. And ultimately, if you see, even though 2,000 years were very unhappy for the Jews, Jacob's dream, his vision, his capitulation, if you will, that we believed was so crazy, came to be a blessing for us here in our beloved America.